This is an ABC podcast.
I was a blackout drinker, so I lost a lot of memories that I can't get back. And I remember the kids asked me one time, I was telling them the story, and they said, oh, were you drunk, Mum? And it sort of made me think, oh, these little kids are picking up, they're 8 and 9, and it just made me think these little kids are picking up on what I'm modelling.
As Dry July approaches, three Victorian women tell their stories about the life-changing effect of quitting alcohol. And sufferers of long COVID in regional New South Wales are being turned away from the state's only treatment centre in Sydney, prompting calls for a greater focus on the condition outside the major cities.
We've got to address this issue. We've got to have access to people, and it can't be just in a few specialty clinics. Now, there's a spectrum of disease, and we need to be able to accommodate for a large number of people.
I'm Alex Hyman, and this is Australia Wide. We start in WA Southwest. Former UK child migrants at Australia's notorious Fairbridge Farm institutions say they again feel betrayed by the national redress system. After a long battle for justice, the Australian government agreed in March 2021 to pay redress claims for the sexual abuse children suffered at 5 Fairbridge institutions across the country. But a group of those child migrants has been told their claims have been frozen as the wrangling over who is responsible continues. Our reporter in WA Southwest is Georgia Loney.
I started to wet the bed, which she didn't like, so she'd make me wash my sheets by hand in a big trough, and then she'd make me get into a cold shower, which my sister, my older sister especially, just fought tooth and nail about and would grab me out of the cold shower and et cetera, et cetera, and basically try and take care of me, you know, because I was just a little kid.
Claire Emmanuel was 5 when she, her parents and 8 brothers and sisters immigrated from the UK to Western Australia in 1966. 8 of the 9 children were sent to the Fairbridge Farm School in Pinjarra, 200 kilometres south of Perth, as their parents tried to get a foothold in a new country.
They were promised that we were all going to go to this beautiful farm school with horses and animals and an Olympic-sized swimming pool, and that we would all be together, kept in the same cottage together. And it was just this utopia, basically, this beautiful place. I mean, they never, ever would have agreed for us to come out here and then get treated like we were and separated and ignored and not allowed to see them, not allowed to see each other. There's no way. You know, we were a happy family. We weren't destitute, we weren't orphans. They just wanted a better life for us.
Claire Emmanuel was one of thousands of children sent from the United Kingdom through programs run by the Fairbridge Society until the early 70s. She says her stay at Fairbridge was meant only to be temporary, but her mother had to battle for years to reunite her family.
Just the meanness of everybody. She wrote letters to the paper. She wrote letters to Australia House. She wrote letters to the people at Fairbridge complaining about how we were treated. She apparently saw bins full of rubbish when she went down there and complained to the health department about that. She just, I think, was at her wit's end because she had no control. She'd lost all her children. I just think it was just such a sad and negative time.
Last year, the Australian government agreed to pay redress payments to children who suffered sexual abuse at Fairbridge institutions. But in December, Claire Emmanuel was told her claim had been frozen. Rick Hinch is the president of the Old Fairbridgians Association of WA and says he's spoken to the redress scheme about the delays.
The main problem, apparently, is not so much what they call the child migrants, but it's the ones who came out under what was known as the two-parent scheme. These kids would come out and they'd be able to stay at Fairbridge allegedly for 3 months, give the parents time to find a house, to find work. And quite a few of those kids who were supposed to be there for only 3 months ended up doing 5, 6, and I think there's even a couple did up to 8 years. And what I understand, trying to determine who is responsible, if there were two groups involved, such as the Commonwealth Government and the West Australian Government, what was their share of responsibility?
The Department of Social Services has acknowledged that there have been delays to processing some Fairbridge applications where the applicant is not a former ward of the state. The spokesperson says the government is working to progress applications as quickly as possible. But for former Fairbridge kids like Claire Emmanuel, the entire experience has left them feeling betrayed again.
Oh, totally let down again. They make you drag it all up. They make you go through a very drawn-out process, then leave you all in a heap, left dealing with agencies that won't get back to you, people who don't know what they're talking about, people who don't have any answers, and, yeah, you're just left hanging.
That story from our reporter in WA Southwest, Georgia Loney. And if you or anyone you know needs help, you can always call Lifeline on 13 11 14.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
You are on Australia Wide with me, Alex Hyman. The New South Wales Bushfires Coronial Inquiry has wrapped up stage one of its hearings this week, looking at the cause and origins of bushfires around New South Wales during the 2019-2020 Black Summer. This week, the inquiry was focused on fires in the southern region around the Bega Valley and Snowy Monaro areas. Earlier this month, it was examining the huge Gospers Mountain fire which threatened Sydney. New South Wales South Coast reporter Jessica Clifford has been following the inquiry and joins me on Australia Wide. Jess, this inquiry has been going on and off for almost a year now. What was it looking at through this month?
Yeah, that's right, Alex. So this month it started out looking at the Gospers Mountain bushfire. Now, this was one of the biggest wildfires ever recorded in the world, and in fact, the biggest ever recorded wildfire in Australia. It burned through more than a million hectares. So that was a fire that burned out the back of Sydney, and anyone listening in Sydney might remember being blanketed in smoke for months on end during that 2019-20 bushfire season. That was the fire that was causing it. So we heard that this fire was started by a single lightning strike in very remote bushland in October 2019, and it really went on to burn for a very long time through until February, right through the World Heritage listed national park in the Blue Mountains and up towards the Central Coast in New South Wales. It destroyed 147 properties, but thankfully no one was injured. And we did hear that it precipitated a number of other fires, including the Gross Valley fire. And this was another huge fire which became quite catastrophic and, you know, also destroyed a lot of bush in the area. There was a little bit of discussion around this fire in particular because there were concerns about, you know, backburns and communication issues when it came to fighting this fire. But we didn't really get too much into any of those things. It was really just looking at the cause and origins. So that was the first couple of weeks of the inquiry. And then, as you mentioned, the last couple of weeks have been more focused on the southern region fires in the Snowy Monaro regions of New South Wales, which are full of snow now, but back then very dry, very hot conditions caused, you know, millions of hectares to be damaged in those areas as well. So very, very sad evidence, I guess you could say, over the last couple of weeks.
What happens now that stage one has wrapped up?
Well, now that stage one has wrapped up, unsurprisingly, we move on to stage two. And this is another quite long process. Essentially, the coroner will look at some examples of fires from around New South Wales. So, you know, there was hundreds of fires. They'll pick, you know, maybe 20. And these will be used as case studies. So they'll have a bit more of an in-depth look at how the fires were fought, what sort of efforts were made to stop them, the impact they had on people. And they'll use these fires to shape findings and recommendations that will come out of this coronial inquiry later on.
It's incredible to think, isn't it, with all that's gone on, those fires from now a couple of years ago, we've had COVID and what have you. When can we expect an outcome on this inquiry?
Yeah, look, it certainly has gone on for a long time, and we're still not expecting any findings or recommendations until probably the later half of next year. As I mentioned, there's still another month's worth of hearings in September. And there's actually also a couple of coronial inquests that still need to be completed. COVID has definitely slowed down the process a little bit. And the inquest that's yet to come is actually the inquest for three firefighters who were killed when their air tanker crashed over the Snowy Mountains. So that is expected to take a couple of weeks in March next year. So, you know, I think we're really looking at possibly another 12 months before we see any recommendations or findings. So, as you say, a long process.
Our reporter on the New South Wales South Coast is Jessica Clifford. Jess, thanks so much for speaking to us again here on Australia Wide.
Thanks, Alex.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
Long COVID sufferers in regional New South Wales are being turned away from the state's only treatment centre in Sydney, prompting calls for a greater focus on the condition outside the major cities. Millions have had COVID, and while many make a full recovery, others deal with persistent symptoms. Pain, inflammation, fatigue and brain fog can start at any time, and long COVID sufferers are desperate. Our reporter in Newcastle, Giselle Wakatama, has more.
33-year-old Natasha Barnett caught COVID over the New Year's Eve party period. She said her life prior to that was active and fun.
Pre-COVID, the social butterfly, and, you know, we jump at the chance to seeing friends and, you know, go for a beach walk and take the puppies for a walk, go see grandma.
Fast forward 6 months.
And it was like an elephant, like, just pushing on your chest. And it was hard to get your breath, like when you wanted to talk or even just walk.
She said her 82-year-old grandmother was more sprightly than her.
She can go to bingo, she can go to happy hour, on a Friday she'll go over and, you know, she'll go see my auntie or her sister.
But look at you.
Yeah, I know. Look at me. Oh. I just don't even feel like the same person anymore. It's really crazy. And I have good days. I'm having more good days that now, but there's still a lot of days. Like even last week, I was just so unwell. I got hit with some other viral infection. The doctor was saying another one, and I was just so sick.
Newcastle Professor Peter Walker's made it his mission to help long COVID sufferers like Natasha by understanding how and why it impacts people in different ways. He's committed to a long COVID study and is concerned about what's to come.
And we talk about long COVID, but in fact, we're really talking about different phases through which the illness really emerges. So we've got the acute phase of the illness, which for some people can be very mild to, of course, incredibly severe to life-threatening. For those people who've got very severe disease, who end up in hospital or requiring breathing support, there is that immediate post-acute phase, and that's something that we've now gained some experience with in Australia. But then there's a really more complicated and a lot more varied group of individuals who have really quite a broad set of symptoms that persist beyond those 3 months or so after their acute illness and unfortunately stretch on much longer.
Natasha Barnett's been desperate, depressed and distraught for months and sought help from the state's only long COVID clinic at St Vincent's Hospital in Sydney. The response wasn't good, turning her away, referring her instead to a local rehab specialist as the clinic had long waiting lists. Professor Walk said without extra clinics in regional areas, the outcomes for hundreds of thousands of people could be dire.
We've got to address this issue. We've got to have access to people, and you're absolutely right. It can't be just in a few specialty clinics. Now, there's a spectrum of disease, and we need to be able to accommodate for a large number of people.
New South Wales Health has told the ABC more long COVID clinics are on the way. The New South Wales government recently announced $19 million in the current budget to fund and establish several new post-COVID clinics across New South Wales for people experiencing lingering symptoms of COVID-19 more than 12 weeks after infection. The clinics will be established across the state from early next year.
Our reporter in Newcastle, Giselle Wakatama, with that story.
ABC Australia Wide.
The pilot will dump fuel and then light the afterburners, and it just shoots out a massive flame of lit up jet fuel. Yeah, it's a party trick.
On ABC Radio.
To Central Victoria now, where three Bendigo women who have given up alcohol at various stages over the past 2.5 years have shared their stories about what motivated them to change their habits. They're sharing their experiences in a bid to encourage others to embrace Dry July, an initiative in which people stop drinking alcohol for the month to raise money for those living with cancer. Bendigo reporter Sarah Lawrence has this story.
Thousands of Australians are set to give up alcohol for the month when Dry July starts on Friday. The challenge aims to encourage people to raise money for those living with cancer. But is it as easy as it seems? Three Bendigo women have given up alcohol at various stages of the past 2.5 years. They've shared their stories about the highlights and challenges they've faced. Hannah Shea is a single mother who works full-time as a caseworker and is also studying sociology and psychology at university. A busy lifestyle was the catalyst for taking a break from alcoholic beverages 3 months ago.
I don't have time for a hangover. I also don't have a stop button. If I drink, I drink all the way. There's no moderation with me. So I decided to just say no from the start and make use of my weekends and my nights off. And it's been a game changer. I'm much more present. It hasn't solved any of my life's problems, but it's made a difference in the way that I can approach things and my peace of mind and less anxiety and stress around things. I'm much more able to cope with life now.
But Hannah admits she hasn't saved money from the change.
So I'm still spending the same. I'm drinking alcohol-free beer, alcohol-free gin and tonic. And I don't think I would have been able to give up alcohol if I didn't have those options. It's not so much the alcohol in the drink that I was dependent on. It was that beautiful of cracking the drink and sitting down to an adult drink that was helping my mindset switch from work to home.
How old are your children and what reaction have they had?
I've got an 8-year-old son and he's super proud of me. He unfortunately had seen some not so pretty things that Mum had done when she'd been drinking. I know he's only 8, but he's also said that, Mum, if you give up drinking, then I won't drink alcohol either. I'll remind him of that again when he's 18, but at least it's sowing the seeds that maybe it's not always the best way to go.
Brianna Cowan has been off alcohol a little longer. She's now reached a year.
The motivator for me was definitely my children. I was a blackout drinker, so I lost a lot of memories that I can't get back. And I remember the kids asked me, telling them a story about something I'd done, and they're like, oh, were you drunk, Mum? They're 8 and 9, and it just made me think these little kids are picking up on what I'm modelling. And I'd had, suffered horrific hangovers, so there's one hangover too many, where I just thought I'd had enough, and so I gave up booze last year. And you know what? I thought I was the only one in Australia that was not drinking. I literally thought, no one's doing this. I'm the only one. Oh my gosh, what am I going to do? I've explored alcohol-free drinks, which have been an amazing tool to use and has enabled me to still have that ritual and that ceremony of, drinking with friends or having a bubbles with a celebration or having a beer after work. So they've been an absolute massive help in keeping on track because there is cravings and there is temptations and all that. But overall, it's been a really positive journey.
And you did a lot of exploring. You did a lot of reading. What kind of things really stood out about when you do binge drink a lot? What impacts it has on you mentally and physically?
You know what? Reading is the best thing because it makes you feel like you're not alone. The emotions that come with the shame, the guilt, the remorse, the regret, which then can lead on to mental health. So reading stories and connecting with like-minded people, it really helps you know that you're not alone and you're not the worst person in the world because you got drunk and you blacked out and you might have said something you shouldn't have. So just knowing that, it definitely helps.
Brianna's experience inspired her to start a podcast with a close friend called Booze Free Bants. And they've discovered the growing range of alcohol-free options.
Even in regional Victoria, I don't think there's any venue I've walked into where they haven't had at least one alcohol-free option. And I'm not talking soft drink, I'm talking alcohol-free beer, an alcohol-free cocktail. So there are options there. So, yeah, don't be afraid to explore them.
For those who've tried Dry July before and failed, Brianna says all is not lost if they want to try again.
I actually did Dry July in 2018. And I really struggled with it. But this time round, not drinking, my mindset has completely changed. So being in the right mindset, I feel, is really important as well. Don't focus on what you're going to miss out on. Focus on what you're going to be gaining is a massive thing.
Christy Niles' competitive nature sparked her alcohol-free quest 2.5 years ago.
I enjoyed a drink. I enjoyed the social aspect and having a bit of fun, but I wasn't enjoying how I felt afterwards. And I guess one day I just felt like I needed to just take a little bit of a break, and I said to myself that I'd take maybe a month off. And I'm a little bit of a competitive type of person, and I actually then put in my mind, wonder if I could do a year. And given that I'm quite invested in health and fitness, I thought, yep, I'm going to do this. And I was able to last out the year. And then I've just decided that it's sort of a continual thing.
And what changes have you noticed?
Definitely more energy. I'm way more productive. I eat a lot better, more focused, and obviously sleep heaps better as well.
When you're around people who are drinking a lot, what do you notice about them?
It's really funny because we've talked about this a lot, involved in footy clubs and social things that we go out to. At first, you know, it's against the status quo and you're kind of looked upon as not normal because you don't drink. But once they all start drinking, they don't even sort of pay attention to what you're doing. I guess I'm a driven person and I think that I'm enjoying myself, having fun. I don't really care what other people think, whether I drink or I don't drink.
And for those considering Dry July, Christy has some advice.
Give it a go for a month. Like, it's not that long. Be driven, be focused, set that goal. And if they want support, reach out for people. I'm there. I'm, you know, I would happily help someone out that needs that little bit of help. And I think it's 1 month of your life, 30 days. It's not that long to give it up. And you'd be surprised at what energy levels they'll have pick up, how better they will feel. And they're making a change to themselves. And I think that's really important.
Our reporter Sarah Lawrence in Bendigo with that story. And finally on Australia Wide. There are strong wind warnings across northern Australia at the moment, which is making life very tough for commercial fishos. Our reporter Matt Brand caught up with Grant Barker, who's just returned to Darwin after catching tropical snappers in the Joseph Bonaparte Gulf. He says it was a rough trip.
Yeah, no, the weather's been terrible the last week or so. There's 1,039 high in the Bight in South Australia, which gives us very strong easterly and southeasterly trade winds. It's been very rough, and I think it'll be rough for the next 5 or 6 days up here, right through the weekend. And there's wind all the way across the top of Australia, all the way down the east coast and all the way down to the Pilbara. So strong wind warnings everywhere, very uncomfortable at sea, makes everyone's life more difficult.
What's it mean to your business?
To the business, it slows us down a bit in terms of it's harder to keep your catch rates up in bad weather. It's difficult for the crew, it's difficult for the skippers. Our catches tend to fall off a bit, but you know, that's fishing and it's part and parcel of it.
Tell me about getting home. It took you a little bit longer than normal, yes?
Yeah, it did take me a bit longer. I had to steam 450 odd nautical miles home straight into that easterly wind, so we had constant 25 knots for 55 hours. It's normally about a 48 hour trip, but it took us 55 just punching up into the sea for 2.5 days, which is not a whole lot of fun for anyone.
And a lot of extra diesel.
A bit of extra diesel, yeah, and that stuff's pretty expensive at the moment, so yeah, but you know, that's fishing.
So if there's strong wind warnings pretty much across the north, what's your point where you don't go fishing?
We can work up to 30 knots pretty comfortably, or it's uncomfortable, but we can safely work 30 knots. Once it gets over 30 to 40 is a bit agricultural, and we'd probably heave to and just jog up into the wind for a day or two until it backs off, and then we can start work again. But we can work, you know, 20 to 30 knots. Okay, uncomfortable, probably a bit more dangerous, but you just got to go a bit slower and get it done.
And in general, what would be your summary of this calendar year so far?
In terms of weather, it's been a very unusual, very, very unusual year. I think it's very late. Like, these trade winds we're getting now are usually around by the end of April. But it's been very calm through April and May. And most of June has been calm as well. But we're now getting belted up by these easterlies. It's a very unusual weather pattern. There's been challenges with COVID and workers, like every business in the country. We're struggling for people, a bit shy on skippers, so it's challenging, but it's okay. Diesel is hurting everybody in business, not just fishing. Every industry is struggling with diesel and rising input costs, so we have to put our fish prices up to try and stay abreast of it. We're going along okay. There's probably people hurting more than us.
Grant Barker there from Northern Wildcatch Seafood Australia, based in Darwin. He was chatting to Matt Brann. And that is Australia Wide for this Thursday. Remember, you can podcast the show or listen back to the program through the ABC Listen app or by visiting the Australia Wide website. Just search for ABC Australia Wide. I'm Alex Hyman. I'll be back again with you tomorrow. I hope you can join me then. I look forward to your company. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.